accession number 23378, reel 7.
You'd mentioned earlier on the tape that you were leading by example. Was there ever a time as you were making your way up the golden staircase that you thought that you just wouldn't have it in you to lead by example, that it was going to be too difficult?
No, I don't think I thought it would be too difficult, but the hardness of it all did surprise me, as it surprised us all. And fortunately we'd had good training and back in Yandina, that we were able to cope with it all in the way in which we did. It was a surprise, certainly. Didn't think a country like that could exist. It's certainly rather like, in a way, the Syrian country that had been through, save and except that there was the jungle in which you couldn't see very far, and also the ground was much softer than it was in Syria, where they're coping with rocks and things of that description. Anyway, that night we had a meal and lay down to sleep where we were, and we were fit enough the next morning. We were all pretty young, you know, in those days. Didn't take much to recoup.
You say you lay down and slept. Presumably not in a formed camp.
No. It was just spot to stop. Native village. No tents, nothing like that. That's a description. No formal tables to sit at for mess. Like a picnic. And off we went again next morning.
Did you have time to discuss the situation, to talk about what your future aims were, or immediate aims were?
No, we were just concentrating what the next day held for us. We got some idea of what we were doing. Strangely enough, the next day was a short trip to a place called Nara. And they said it would be easier, but it's never easy in going over the Outer Stanley's. Got you to get to B from A, you've got to go up hills and down dales. It's never a straight trip.
You mentioned it was like a roller coaster, but not quite as fast.
That's right. Anyway, we're grateful for the short trip the next day, because it enabled us to wash and in the creek nearby. Off we went again then to a place called Benari the following day. Benari was south of the what was become the infamous Brigade Hill. The following day we went over the Brigade Hill to Fogi, which is north of the Brigade Hill. And there we had a sing-song and lit fires, because that was the last time we could do anything like that, because the next step was getting closer to the Japanese. And it was a lovely night, really. Fires going, and it's cold, of course, because we were high up in the mountains by that time. Everyone relaxed. Then the next day we were off to Maala.
I understand Maiola was the place that you were to get supplies. Up until this time, what had the weather conditions been like?
Normal. Cold at night. Wet at night. If you slept on a slope, you had to make certain that you had a wedge that if you moved during the night, you didn't slip over and slide down the hill. It would have been catastrophic if you did that. you dry off from the wet weather during the day, but that was, sweat took its place. And this patent, hot during the day, and then the rains came in late afternoon, and rain, you got wet again. That was the conditions of the Standing Mountains. We did make use of the good weather for a few hours, especially if you're an airman, you wouldn't be able to do anything.
Do you recall some of the tunes, some of the songs that you were to sing before you set off to Myola, the next step?
We had a fellow there called Stan Bissett, who was the adjutant. I beg your pardon, he was the intelligence officer. Stan had been in the Wallabies, and he'd made a tour to England just prior to the war. When they got to England, war was declared, and they came home again without playing a game. So we had quite a few rugby songs and a few South African songs, Sari Maya, all of that. He had a beautiful voice, Stan. Then there was the usual Waltzing Matilda and so on. But everyone, when I say let their hair down, I don't mean no grog or anything of that description, but everyone sort of felt relaxed. They felt they had achieved something so far.
Given the severity of the trip at this point, how would you have rated morale?
Well, it was evidenced in the sing-song. Nobody'd want to sing if their morale was low. There was an eagerness to take part, especially when we knew that this would be the last time we could really, let our hair down, in a sense.
Was this a feeling that was universal through the group, would you say? Were there people that isolated themselves or were a little concerned, possibly?
What do you mean by group?
The group of men that you were now singing with.
Oh, it was universal through them. The battalion, yes. 546.
To what degree were you interacting with the second 16?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, you can only get one man along the track at a time. That meant that to move 546 people over the track meant that only one unit could sort of occupy the track, the second 16th, the second battalion up. They followed on, they set off a day later. So they were not near us until we got to Myola.
Tell us then of the situation. You're off to Myola, Lake Myola, to get provisions, to get the supplies that were supposed to be dropped there.
That's so.
Tell us what the trip there was like and what it was like to arrive.
Well, the trip from Faggy to Myola was no different to most trips, except that there were patches of kunai grass which were higher than yourself, and they were just really hot, steamy. It was for a short period in March, otherwise it was just like any other March. Myola was just a clearing, really. There's no water there, really. It was just dried up like. was found by a fellow called Kainzel, a rubber plantation owner. Then with ANGOW, the Australian New Guinea Administration Unit. And we got to Bala, and there we had a change of clothes, and we washed and cleaned and made and mended, waiting for rations to come in. They never came because of the air raid in Moresby just after we left. And you can't fight without rations. You can't fight without ammunition. So therefore the grand plan, as we knew it at that stage, that we were going to go forward from Myla with full bellies and full haversacks and anything else that we could adjust, and take Kokoda and sweep the Japanese out of New Guinea, couldn't take place because we didn't have the wherewithal with which to do it. So we were making, or brigade headquarters was making its plans as it went along. The lack of rations was a very bitter pill to swallow. Potsy had been assured of the rations and they didn't arrive. And there was backbiting down in the Port Moresby amongst people responsible. An army moves into on stomach, so Napoleon said. He was dead right. So we have a very good chance of being right dead, I suppose. Anyway, we moved on.
How long were you at Myla for?
A couple of days. We moved on to Templeton's Crossing, and then on to Eora Creek to Usher Harbour. We had set off on the 16th of August, and we arrived on the 26th. The first company arrived on the 26th of August.
As you approached, what was your knowledge of the situation at Usuraba?
Well, we passed through Alala, which is an hour's walking time south of Usuraba, on the Moresby side of Usuraba. Brigade headquarters had been set up there, and Colonel Key had moved forward to Alala to be with the brigadier. And we were told the situation, which was that the 39th were almost at the end of their tether. The Japanese were strong, but we didn't know their full strength that we were to meet in a few days' time. So we got all the information as it was possible to get, because the 39th had fed the brigade headquarters, and we knew we were in for a fight.
You mentioned earlier on that you were eager to get into action. Would you say that the eagerness was still there, given that you were now short on supply?
Well, the eagerness was still there because, like everything else in life, you made an effort to do something, you want to do it when the time arrives. And we knew that we were fighting for the existence of Australia. It would seem remote high up in the Owen Stanleys that Australia was anywhere near us, but our thoughts constantly were for our loved ones back home, and what we were doing was in the forefront of the battle.
You mentioned earlier on that you understood what was likely to be the situation on your arrival. What sorts of discussions were you having with your other commanding officers? people like Keyes, people like Potts?
Well, I was not privy to those discussions because it wasn't my role to be there. My role as second in command was to make certain that the battalion was moving along and making certain there were no stragglers and things like that. My role at that stage was more administration than the fighting role. That was in the hands of battle headquarters, consisting of the CO, the adjutant, the intelligence officer, and so on. But as we passed through Alala, you were told what was there. They had a sand table there which indicated what was what. When we got, when the battalion reached Alala, the fifth leading company, C Company, was sent on to Isharaba post haste because things were pretty grim then. They reached us around about 5 o'clock on the 26th of August, Wednesday, the 26th of August. They immediately were welcomed by the 39th, who were expecting the 2nd 14th to come along. They were very pleased to see us, of course. We just took over their positions. When I say we, I mean the C Company did.
Can you describe a little bit to us your initial impressions of the position that you were to take?
Well, you couldn't see too much. There were a couple of small open spaces which had been native gardens, and apart from that, it was high ground and jungle, sloping away from the high ground on the west to the low ground across the track to the east, down to the Eora Creek, which separated the Kokoda track from the track which branched off at Alala to Abuari. If you can imagine a track going to Kokoda and Kokoda down to the coast, this track to Abuari cut off the Kokoda leg, the third side of the triangle, went straight from Isharaba, Alala rather, down to up to Abuari, which is on the north side, the seaside, the Gona side of Kokoda. So you bypassed, in a sense, Kokoda. It might have been possible for the Japanese, and some of them did do it, of course, to go from Abuari to Alala and cut us off. And that's where the two captains, the 2nd, 16th, went to towards Abuari to make that a remote possibility. First 2 days, as the B Company came over to come in next, they went up on the high ground to the west, which was to be the important ground, as it turned out, in the next hours to come. And then came Don Company and then A Company, which were Don Company filled in the gap between C Company on the right-hand side of the track and B Company on the left-hand side of the track up on the high ground, and A Company were in reserve. After that, the specialists came in, the headquarter company. And the battalion was fully assembled on the Saturday morning. First 2 days, the Wednesday and Thursday, the 26th and 27th of August, both sides spent in patrolling. The 39th, prior to that, had kept the Japanese at bay. The Japanese were building up from 2,000 men to 10,000 men in the time in which they landed, the 21st of July, to the 16th of August, the 26th of August. They'd been building up and building up, and so by the time of Friday, the 28th of August, they were ready to go, and they went.
Prior to that, can you give us a description of your understanding of the condition that the men of the 39th were in?
Well, I'm on record as saying at the time to some, at the very time to somebody, and my surprise at the condition of the 39th Militia Battalion. We saw what was left of the 39th. They heard what they had been through. We heard what they had been through. And I was personally surprised to see that men who looked so down and out could come back for more. They were volunteering to stop with us. And we were gratified because we needed every person. Anyone who could hold a rifle or a gun was needed. It was amazing how the two sides of the army, AIF and militia, came together without let or hindrance. It was encouraging. It was a morale booster.
That was something that you wrote for a speech that you gave.
No, that was something that I said on the spot to some, maybe Chester Wilmot or somebody like that, Power or somebody. I was asked for a comment, and that's the comment I gave. I meant it, because here was Australians who enlisted under one lot of volunteers and the other ones raised in a compulsory fashion for the defence of Australia. And this so happened whilst we were in New Guinea. It was Australian mandated territory. Here were two sides coming together to fight for Australia, not caring whether they were called militia or AIF. We were blood brothers. And it was a remarkable moment.
You were just reading from a speech that you were to have given. Tell us about that and when that was given.
That was read in a speech which I gave on the Battle for Australia commemoration service on the 6th of September 2000, the Shrine of Remembrance, Melbourne, in the presence of the service chiefs and school children, probably numbering about 1,000.
What was the response when you were to give that speech?
Well, I understand it has made a great impression upon the children, and the history section of the state school system, who had the conduct of the children, government schools, published it in their quarterly magazine, in full, unedited, and this was circulated to the government schools in the state of Victoria. So there's tacit approval of what I said.
You mentioned the Battle of Vitarava as one of the main battles to save Australia. Tell us now, if you can, about the beginning of that battle.
Well, as I said, the first 2 days, 26th, 27th, the Thursday, Wednesday and the Thursday, was spent in patrolling. The Japanese were trying to find out. They realised, as it transpired, there were fresh Australian troops in the area. They were determining our flanks, where possible weak points were. The Japanese used to come up against the front line of the opposition, and then fan out and come round the flanks. This is what they were attempting to establish during those first 2 days. But on the third day in the morning, they opened up with all their heavy artillery, their mountain guns, their machine guns, their long-range weapons, and they fired along the whole front, really. And there were... Our troops stood their ground. There were casualties on both sides, of course. But it transpired from very much later that the Japanese were surprised that they were held up at all. They thought it was just a walkover. All they had to do was to keep moving. And it was estimated that they'd lost hundreds of troops during that fighting.
Given the fact that you were being bombarded, what were the feelings that you had initially of your situation?
I don't suppose on the Friday there was much of a realisation that we were... what was to occur on the Saturday night, when we had to adjust our position. But it was just part of a normal battle, which had to be yet to be won.
As I understand, this would have been your first case of severe close-range combat. What? How did you cope with that, would you say?
The troops coped with it very well. It was a surprise to many of them that the Japanese were so close, not more than a cricket pitch away on occasions. In fact, on one occasion, there must have been many of them like it. A fellow would move a branch in front of him to find that there was a Japanese just on the other side of the branch, and they're peering at each other. It was quite quick action by the Aussie to deal with it. It was fighting at very close quarters for our fellows. Next day, the Saturday, the same thing happened, and we get the marvellous actions of everyone. In fact, there was a fellow called Alan Avery who won a military medal in Syria. It was given to say he thought that everybody should get a decoration in the Kokoda battle, because everyone did their bit, some more than most. There's the example of McCallum, who with Ben Gunn and Tommy Gunn alternately firing his gun so that his platoon could withdraw from a position. And the Japanese were so close to McCallum that they bust his ammunition pouches off his body. It was really like a melee in Australian rules football. Everyone's on top of each other. He kept firing, and he had tens of Japanese dead in front of him. He was successful. He was submitted for a Victoria Cross, I understand, but he got the next highest honour, Distinguished Conduct Medal. He was an interesting fellow. He was to lose his life on the 6th of September at the Battle of Brigade Hill. but he was a farmer down in South Gippsland in Victoria, a place called Yarram. He worked on his father's farm. He was a local wood chopping champion, and as you did in those days, there was the local dance on the Saturday night in the local hall, and he used to play the accordion for them.